Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, welcome to the 288th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patron Lala Halsema. Thanks, Lala. I'm Matt Enlow.
And I'm Warren Kaplan, and today you got just the two of us again. You're in for a treat. We're going to talk about film festivals, regional fests, to be more specific. We're going to talk about short films. And was there anything else, Matt?
You know, I did want to talk a little bit about the creative process and maybe kick it off with that, actually.
Oh.
Because off the mic, you and I have been brainstorming on a cool visual idea you had. And I thought, oh, this is kind of an interesting thing to talk about on the show.
Yeah.
And kind of dovetails a lot of the different things that we've both been experimenting with and talking about on the show. Basically, you had this idea, this cool kind of like visual thing that you were trying to figure out. You screen shared it with me. You were like, oh, check out this cool thing I'm working on. I had some opinions. We kind of threw things back and forth. And it's been super fun, right? And I think mostly you've just kind of been able to run solo without anybody's help. But I feel like talking about it maybe helps you solidify your opinions a little bit more, even though I think we disagreed on the approach a little bit.
Yeah, and I mean, to be honest, like, I think I shared it with you because, if it was cool, I'd probably share it with you, but this is a situation where I had an idea, I tried to make some test videos, and it totally did not work. And so I shared it with you to see if you could help me figure out why it wasn't working.
Right. Well, and I think we got there, but I think the reason I wanted to bring it up is because I think, like, talking about it out loud and being challenged on certain aesthetic ideas or approaches, sometimes, you know, you're open to ideas. You would have changed your mind if I had pitched something that you liked. But I think it did solidify what you liked about things, even though I was kind of like pointing at something slightly different.
Yeah, I find this in like a lot of like home DIY type of stuff is that like, anyone can watch a YouTube video and figure out how to, you know, install their own backsplash or whatever. But it's kind of scary to just do it by yourself, to go buy the cement, you know, the mortar and to get the tiles.
Yeah, you just want to point at something and be like, does this look right to you?
Yeah. And so just having somebody next to you, a friend, even if they've never done it before either, just to talk things out loud and have them like notice things or not notice things or throw out good ideas and bad ideas. Can really help you get through something. I do wonder. I wonder if there's like, you know, there's these like auteur directors like a Wes Anderson. I wonder how much they sit around and get pitched ideas, like artistic ideas, and how much they change their mind based on things.
Well, I mean, Wes is an easy example. Most of his movies he's co-written with someone. First it was Owen Wilson, then it was Roman Coppola, right? So he has serious collaborators there.
Noah Baumbach too, right? Wasn't he involved?
Yeah, I think so. He consistently works with the same few DPs. I wouldn't be surprised if there's a lot of other crew members who are consistent collaborators.
Yeah, and so costume designer, probably art director,
sure,
or production designers.
Yeah, and I think he started with Mark Mothersbaugh for composition and then went to Andre Desplat. But, you know, the point being, like, there are a lot of quote-unquote auteurs, and then you look at oh, they've been consistent with their team for years and years. And oftentimes if you're like, boy, I loved them so much, and then something changed and all of a sudden I don't love their movies anymore. Sometimes it's that linchpin crew member moved on.
Right.
You know,
or they decided to try something with a new crew member, mm-hmm, and it mm-hmm, just, yeah, it doesn't feel like what
it's
you
not
were
the
looking
same
for
anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, truly, I do miss, I really, really loved those early Wes Anderson movies, and I realized that I just love Owen Wilson.
Right. Yeah. He is, he's pretty lovable. Yeah. I wonder if there are filmmakers that kind of get to set, or, you know, in pre-production are just like, nope, we're doing it my way. Like, this is my, like, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously in a commercial or something that wouldn't happen, but maybe on a short film, if you want to make your own thing and you have your passion project, like, I bet there are filmmakers that are like, nope, this is exactly how it has to be. Mm-hmm. I personally enjoy the, like, hey, here's my idea. What do you guys think? Like, ooh, it could be better. Like, to me, the joy of filmmaking is the collaborating. And if it was a job that you did 100% by yourself, I don't think I would want to be a filmmaker.
But I guess maybe what I was getting at is that whether you take the idea or not, testing your quote-unquote vision with collaborators who get what you're aiming for and have good ideas and have the vocabulary and understanding to pitch things in a valuable way is cool. It's nice. It's valuable. And like we talk about, you know, finding your tribe or finding collaborators. And this was like a fun reminder of like, oh yeah, it's nice to just do this stuff. And also as a person who isn't working on this project at all and like was looking to procrastinate on my own stuff, it was nice to not have any stakes. You know what I mean? Like I had a different idea that I wanted you to do and you were like, nah, not really. And,
right. But you,
that's fine.
But you know,
it was easy.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, okay, great.
Now that you say that, I have been in the situation many times where other directors have been like, hey, Oren, can I just bounce some ideas off of you? And we'll mm-hmm. talk about something and I'll be like, I'll pitch like, ooh, what if we do this? What if it's like we shoot it from an airplane or whatever? And they're like, nah, that's not really what I'm picturing. But then a lot of times I'll be like, oh, well, maybe I can keep that idea for myself.
Sure.
Like I came up with this really fun. A lot of times I like literally just misunderstand what they're going for and I'll pitch something that mm-hmm. I get super excited about for them. And when I realize that I'm totally off the mark, I get excited for myself and I have like a list of ideas, yeah, especially visual ideas that I like to keep in my notes on my phone. And I'm like, ooh, what if, you know, whatever, like somebody's shadow is just doing the opposite thing of what right. they're doing, whatever, like just things like that.
I, you know, it makes me think of, not to tell a bunch of anecdotes about directors I've never met, but I remember Spike Jonze talking about how he would be influenced by movies he hadn't seen because Sofia Coppola would tell him about them.
Mm, that's funny.
And then he would go do like a music video or he would do like a riff on that idea and then see the movie later and be surprised and maybe disappointed. It doesn't matter.
Right.
But it was totally different than what he was thinking.
Yeah, no, that I imagine yeah. that happens a lot, and that's kind of the beauty of the mind. There's you know, Hayden Hillier Smith, is that his name?
Mm-hmm.
Hayden.
Mm-hmm.
He made this video that I found kind of interesting, which was about where you can get ideas and where you can find inspiration and how you can come up with what you should make. And he was like, just copy other people, like just copy the things you like and make them. And literally by you making it, it's like a different.
Yeah.
Like your filter on things, even if it feels like something you've seen before, it will be like your own version of it. So yeah, it's fun to collaborate like that. And it made me think of, you know how everyone is like always talking about the iPhone, like nowadays you can just shoot a feature on an iPhone. You can just make mm-hmm. like what, and there's nothing stopping you. Just go and just shoot it. And you can just use your phone. I feel like that's something that's just is said all the time. And while I kind of disagree with it, and I think a lot of people are like, yeah, but then like I want to do shallow depth of field, or I want to, you know, put it on a dolly, and I want to do all these fun things, like cinematic things. But I think if you think of your phone as this kind of halfway tool, like you don't have to go shoot your thesis film on your iPhone or your spec commercial mm-hmm. or whatever, but if you are brainstorming, like grab your phone and go shoot yourself doing something and put your phone, like just lean it on a wall. And I do that a lot. You know, even that thing I showed you today, I just put my phone on a selfie stick and like rotate it around me in a weird way and try to see how it edited together. And it totally didn't do anything that I wanted it to. But I think a lot of people, when they're kind of brainstorming and ideating, they're like sitting at their laptop, they're at the mm-hmm. coffee shop, they're watching references.
Yeah, but, yeah. Or just staring at a blank page.
Yeah.
And that's oftentimes not as helpful as just getting something on paper and maybe in a medium of moving images, shooting the roughest version you can.
The bad version.
Starts you off. Yeah, shoot the bad version. I think the other thing, we talked about this a little bit in our previs episode, but just for listeners at home, basically you were just trying to figure out an effect of like a way to get a character to enter and exit a scene in a unique way, right? Mm-hmm. That's kind of the bottom line there.
Yeah.
And there are 1,000 different ways to do it, and kind of like, I think I was coming at it from a more tactile, maybe, perspective is what I was trying to push for, and I think you were maybe doing something a little bit more fantastical. Doesn't matter. Again, it forces you to kind of decide what your point of view is. But what I love about what you were doing is that even in figuring it out, it's just so hard to explain the specific move that you're trying to do. But now, with a little bit of time and a little bit of refinement, you can show it to people and be like, hey, I did this at home. You get it. Everyone gets it. And you can explain to them how to pull off what you're aiming for in a way that if you were just like in a meeting with people and you were like, no, trust me, it'll be really cool. If I place the camera here and do this, it'll look awesome. Like, that just won't fly with people, you know?
Yeah, or the even worse, and this has happened to me, especially earlier in my career, it has flown with people, and they're like, oh, okay, he seems so confident that this thing is going to work. Let's just trust him. Mm-hmm. Let's do it. And then you do it, and then you're like,
and you're like, uh-oh, shoot.
Kind of. It worked, but it's not interesting at all, or, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. It's just not nearly as cool as I imagined.
Or if you'd done it once or twice before already, you'd know how to plus it and make it better and get it closer to what you were dreaming of.
Just shoot it, guys and gals.
Yeah, yeah. Everyone. I think also the final bit about it that I think is valuable is that like none of what you're doing, you're modeling some stuff in 3D, which is quite advanced, but most of what you were doing is just process, is not out of the realm of feasibility for anybody with a camera. It's just that you have to take the time to figure out how to do the thing you're trying to do. Mm-hmm. And so I guess I'm just trying to encourage people, if you've got a weird idea, most of you have the tools at your fingertips to make it work. And it's the thing that the premium is on the person who figures out how to do it right, you know, and that just takes iteration and practice. Like what you're pitching isn't especially complicated or hard or expensive. It's just that the workshopping is the thing that you're investing in.
Yeah. I'm curious, actually, you had kind of a similar thing recently. You had this shot where you wanted a character to throw a set of keys to another character, and the camera mm-hmm. pans kind of in slow motion with the keys as they fly across mm-hmm. the location in the air. And you filmed some keys spinning mm-hmm. on a green screen. Just mm-hmm. with your Blackmagic 6K Pro, which mm-hmm. thank you, Blackmagic, for sending that to us. And then you showed it to me, and I was like, whoa, did you get this like from a stock footage site? This looks so good. Mm-hmm. And you just shot it like literally in your apartment. And then you went to set, and you had this whole setup to shoot it again. Mm-hmm. I'm curious if the stuff you shot on set was any better than what you shot at home, because sometimes you shoot it at home and you're like, oh, this could be way mm-hmm. better. And other times you're like, actually, what I did at home was better than what I did on set.
It was better, yes. Yeah, it was better. But only slightly. It was just that the circumstances were right. You know, like the lighting setup made more sense. We had lights and people to kind of execute things. But like, was it drastically different from what I did in my apartment? No. No, not drastically different. Like, if push came to shove, we probably could use the footage that I shot.
Yeah. I find, depending on the genre, but, like, if it's comedy or if there is something kind of broad or hokey or silly or, like, off-kilter about it, sometimes the tests you do at home end up being more fun to watch. Mm-hmm. More like a Zach King Vine, you know, the Vine mm-hmm. magician, like, or more of, like a cool TikTok effect than, like, a really polished commercial, you know, mm-hmm. that you're like, yeah, that whatever. You got a visual effects team. They did that thing. It's not that impressive, but it looks pretty cool when it's on a handheld device, you know, just in somebody's car while they're driving. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah. It's fun. I mean, that honestly, like, this stuff is what attracted me to filmmaking, like, when I was a quote-unquote kid. I mean, I was, like, basically in college, but it was, like, shooting things on a video camera, putting them in my computer, like, bringing them into After Effects or Premiere or whatever.
And making something cool.
Yeah, and seeing if I can, like, elicit a reaction from my friends.
Yeah, showing your friends, I think, is a thing for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So, cool. Well, yeah. Create, we'd love to hear about your own creative processes, especially when it comes to visuals. We've learned some, like, really interesting things on the podcast over the years and about how people come up with visual things. But if you guys have anything you want to share with us, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at justshootitpod@gmail.com. I know it sounds like I'm doing the outro. I'm not, but I just feel like on these Matt and Oren episodes, like, it's, as we move from topic to topic, it'd be great to remind you all that we'd love to hear your tips and tricks and tidbits and inspirations for filmmaking as well.
Also tools, you know, I think is really nice. I love it when I learn of a specific program, you know, that's always great as well. Like those small niche sort of programs I think are exciting as well.
Yeah.
We all know the kind of the big stuff, but it's like, sometimes it's nice to add another program to your arsenal, a little app or something.
Hey, we're here with Nate Watkin from Assemble, the platform for producers that lets you do everything you need in one place. So one thing that I'm always really bad at is calendars and figuring out when I'm supposed to do things and when things are due. And I'm constantly missing deadlines for various projects.
Podcasts, even.
I potentially miss, you know, some podcasts. Can you tell me about Assemble's calendar tool and how you coordinate and sync with other people? Obviously, production is a very calendar intensive task.
Yeah, absolutely. We wanted to build a very powerful calendar built from the ground up for producers. And so one of the core features to Assemble is the production calendar builder, which enables you to build out your production timeline, create subtasks, assign them to your team. You can even switch views from a month view to a timeline view to get more of a Gantt style view of how your project is coming together. And it's packed with a bunch of other tools that producers love, such as the ability to bulk drag and drop and bulk shift your entire calendar all at once.
So, Nate, I'm curious, what specifically about calendar management was inspiring to you? What problem were you trying to solve?
Yeah, one thing that we found is calendar management is really bad in this industry. Oftentimes, the calendar just gets sent as a PDF or sometimes just typed in to an email. And what we really lack is the ability to have dynamic calendars. And the challenge is because everybody's on a different calendar. Some people use iCal, some people use Google Cal, and it's hard to get everybody onto one calendar. And that's what Assemble solves, because within Assemble, when you build a calendar, you can share it as a public link that anybody can access with no Assemble account required. And from that link, they can sync it to any calendar of their choice, whether that's iCal, Google Cal, or Microsoft. So once people have connected in however they want, you have a centralized hub calendar that is dynamic. And anytime updates are made, they're updated across everybody's calendars on all platforms.
That's awesome. So if I use Google Cal and Matt uses iCal and you change a date of a podcast recording, that would propagate to us and we would get some sort of alert.
Exactly. It's dynamic, it's updated in real time, and it keeps everybody on the same page. It also saves you a ton of back and forth emails updating people on the calendar status and where everything stands.
Great. Well, so if people want to check out this calendar, this production calendar system, and the other things that Assemble does, like asset management, getting feedback, sharing videos, where can people go to learn more and sign up?
Yeah, absolutely. You can head over to assemble.tv, sign up for a 30-day free trial. And listeners to this podcast are also getting an additional 30 days free by using the coupon code JustShootItPod.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Speaking of creative tricks, and I'm totally going off script here, but probably the most mind-blowing thing I've seen in the last month was a post from Jordan Brady on Instagram where he showed how he prints furniture, two-dimensional versions of furniture that he wants to use in a shot. Did you see that?
No, that's dope, though. I love
that. He had this shot that he wanted. I think he was doing a montage of all these different shots, and one of them was in this doctor's office, but he knew that it's only going to be a wide shot in this doctor's office, and it's going to play from one angle, and he wanted, you know, to have all these, like, tables and shelves and different doctor things, you know, like those metallic rolling drawers, and I think from a resource or budget or time, for some reason, they couldn't bring, like, furnish this entire doctor's office. So they just brought in the chair that the patient sits on, you know, like a real doctor's office chair. But then he had the art department print, you know, he knew what angle he wanted to see these things from. So he got pictures of them from the right angle. He had them print them on, like, foam core. And he literally just stands them on set to camera. And it looks real, like if you look at it, you're like, yep,
that's so
this
good.
Person's in a doctor's office. And it was kind of a stylized set as well, so you weren't, like, looking for, like, so carefully at the shadows and all the things. But
Right. It's just a moment.
But yeah, and that's, I'm sure, like, an idea that he probably tested out on it, you know, with his handy cam, and then did it. So anyhow, okay, let's move on to our next topic, regional film festivals.
That's right. Regional film festivals, baby.
So, Matt, tell us what you consider a regional film festival.
Sure. Yeah, I don't know what the rule of thumb is exactly, but I think that there's, you know, festivals that are the big marketplaces, the kind of like those, you know, your Sundance's, Toronto's, South By's, etc., you know, like kind of the big ones. And then there's a lot of, like, second tier festivals and third tier festivals, oftentimes, that are kind of,
what's, like, a second tier, know, like, would you consider, like, LA Film Festival or AFI or, like, New York or San Francisco? Like,
yeah, I think for instance, I was at the Breckenridge Film Festival, which is a charming, wonderful festival in a ski resort town, Breckenridge, right, outside of Denver, and that to me is, like, the perfect example of a regional festival.
So that's like a region. What about Nantucket? That one's kind of famous, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would. It certainly is.
What about Palm Springs Shorts?
Mm-hmm. Palm Springs Shorts. I love that festival.
It qualifies you for an Oscar.
Yeah.
I think that's what they're famous for.
I really, really am very fond of that one. But I would say, yeah, I would call that a regional festival. Basically, my definition would be anything that's not.
You're not selling a lot.
Not a major marketplace, exactly. Yeah. So I think that there are plenty of people out there who would look at a festival that's not a marketplace and be like, "Well, why bother?" Right? Like, it's not.
Right.
My agent doesn't care about whether or not I won best comedy at the Breckenridge Film Festival. So why should I?
Right.
It's kind of the thing that I wanted to talk about. And there's a handful of really great reasons, actually. Basically, I want listeners to walk away with an understanding that film festivals aren't only about sales, necessarily, and that there are a lot of very tangible ways that you can advance your career attending these other festivals, basically.
There is kind of this third type of film festival, right, which is like more like topic specific, like a Fantastic Fest or Outfest or like Black Film Festival or
I would put those in a slightly different
bucket.
Category, because a lot of those festivals, even though they're not quote unquote marketplaces, are very well supported by the communities that they're centered around. So you can find agents, you can find managers, you can make sales. Right.
They also have
there's big corporate sponsorships.
Yeah, they have built-in marketing, right? Like if it's a horror film festival, you know who you're going to, if you buy a movie here, who you're going to sell that movie to.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly, exactly. So like, yeah, Fantastic or Beyond or Fantasia, those are all meaningful marketplaces, even though they're not, you know, Sundance Next or whatever.
Right.
So, but yeah, so what I'm talking about is like, you know, a film festival in a resort town. I'm talking about going to Ojai. I'm talking about going to Breckenridge or Durango or, you know.
Yeah. Maitland, Florida. That's where the Florida Film Festival is.
Sure, there you go. I mean, Oren, you with The Hammer, you guys toured a lot, right? And like, you played some big fancy festivals, but you also played some smaller ones as well.
Yeah, we did the, like, I kind of feel like the quintessential California second tier, like solid second tier, undeniably second tier is the Newport Beach Film Festival.
Sure, and it's a great festival, for sure.
Yeah, you know, we played Florida and Miami film festivals, and which were both very different from each other, and both super fun. We played Napa Valley, you know, which is just all they care about is wine. I mean, it's just like so insane.
They really do only care about wine.
I've been to Cleveland a couple times.
I love Cleveland. Yeah, that's great.
And that's an interesting one. It's almost like a, not like a blue collar film festival, but like the people there are more interested in watching the movies than talking to the filmmakers, I find, which is like a plus and a minus. Like the people like the movies. Napa Valley, they like go there for the wine and they like might catch a movie and stay awake through the whole thing if you're lucky. And they go for the parties. And what's the one at the Ace in New York? Oh, Tribeca. you know, there's like a lot of kind of industry ones, but the Cleveland ones, like some of those Midwestern ones are really, we played at a Heartland film festival. Yeah. And it's like,
Our film is playing Heartland as well.
Oh, cool. Yeah. And it's more about people aren't like, ooh, I want to meet the actors or the directors as much as like, oh, that movie was really heartwarming. I want to show it to my friends.
And to be fair, I think that there are plenty of people who are excited to talk to the filmmakers, but it is a different experience. Yeah,
they don't ask you what camera you shot on and what your budget was.
Yes. Yes, exactly. They're like, oh, well, how did you make your movie? Was it fun?
Yeah. Or they'll ask you about the topic of the movie, you know? And you're like, this is...
Yeah, yeah.
It's a sad time in history.
So that to me, you brought up the point of like there being a community there. And one of the things that is true is that like it does recharge your batteries. You know, I walked away from this festival screening for real people who liked the movie and even sometimes don't like the movie. That's okay too. But it's like you're reminded that like, oh, we're making movies for an audience and not just an industry audience, right?
Yes, and people are a lot less cynical. Like, you know, you go to AFI or Sundance or whatever to get the reviews from the critics, and you're like praying that they like it. But you go to Heartland or Cleveland because you want to see real people enjoy your movie.
As a little tip, don't go to the bathroom right after your movie.
Oh.
Because you'll be there, that you're at a movie theater or, you know, somewhere public. And so like you will overhear like,
oh, people talking about
person
your movie. Yes.
Being like, oh boy, I didn't like that one. you know?
Yeah.
Like somehow there's something about like you're all kind of crowded in this public space, but they can feel like they can vent a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
So if you, you know, if you're not sure your screening went as well as you wanted or you're feeling in a fragile place, which is reasonable if you haven't screened your movie a bunch of times, you know, maybe wait a little bit
that
before
is
that crowd is cleared out.
A really good tip, actually, and I've never thought of it. I've told this story before, but my movie, it's called The Hammer, but on the festival run, it was called, or on the festival circuit, it was called Hamel, which, you know, this is like everybody knows this, but I will just double down on trying to not change your title from the festival circuit to the release. Yeah. But it was called Hamel, and at the end of the movie, I was kind of like walking out with some of the people that had just seen it, and they didn't know who I was. And I heard one woman say to her friend, like, I don't know, don't blame me. I thought it was about Dorothy Hamel. It's called Hamel. It's a sports film. I don't know. Sorry. So, yeah, I totally hear you. To be honest, I think you and I are different in this regard, but I watched my movie at the premiere and never again in the theater with people. Actually,
yeah.
I would always watch like the first 5 minutes to make sure the sound and stuff is feeling right.
It's going okay.
And the picture looks right, but yeah.
Well, but The Hammer's not funny. You can sense if an audience is with you and with the movie and if they're reacting in the right ways. But like the juice you get from real laughs is nice. And also, you know, so with the movie I'm touring with now, my wife wrote and directed See You Next Christmas, it's not a gut buster, do you know what I mean? It's by design, it's charming, it's entertaining, it's engaging.
Yeah, there's some drama.
Like, yeah, there's drama. It's a rom-com, you know, so it's not meant to be like a huge laugh out loud, you know.
Yeah.
Yucktacular, like you're not going to see like a Bridesmaids or something like that. You know what I mean?
It just occurred to me that instead of dramedy, you could call it a dromcom.
We just call it a rom. It's a straight rom-com.
Right, right.
But also, you know, seeing it with an audience, you're like, oh yeah, I've heard this joke literally 1,000 times. They're hearing it for the first time and they loved it. Like they laugh. They're like, oh, I thought that was a B+ joke and it's getting an A+ laugh.
Yeah, but
that's awesome.
I mean, this is going to sound crazy, but don't you get bored of watching your movie for the 100th time? Like, you've already watched it so many times in the edit. So many times. And then my movie is also, like, kind of long. It's like, it was an hour and 48 minutes, which for, like, an indie film is kind of, you know, a little bit on the long side.
Yeah. We're clocking it at 100 on the money, basically.
100 minutes?
Yeah.
Yeah. So
yeah.
That's good. That's an hour and 40 minutes, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Not that much shorter, I guess. But I love the Q&A. The Q&A is my favorite part of touring with my film. Because, you know, you get better at them and you can start kind of like know the stories that people like.
Sure, what connects and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I would say actually the podcast has helped me with that as well. You kind of learn what stories are pertinent and valuable to people.
Oh, yeah. But you know that, Matt, you know that I play a laugh track for you, right? While we record the podcast, so you feel like people are laughing at your jokes.
Oh, that
but
makes
that's
so
not,
much more
those
sense.
Aren't real people.
Yeah, but it's a lot of B+ jokes with a lot of A+ laughter, so.
Thank you. I'll take that as a compliment for my laugh selection.
Yeah. Your mixture, your mixing job. I hear you. I'll say this. This last screening, one of our lead investors and executive producers came out. It was the first time he'd seen the movie. And halfway through, my wife leans over to him and reminds him that he's the one who wrote that joke that just landed.
Mm.
Like he had pitched something and was like, oh, wouldn't it be funny if they said this? But when he read the script, he had like a few of the pitches and some of them were great and she took them.
Right.
And
that's when the main character says, take my wife, please.
Yeah, exactly. But I'll tell you what, man, the electricity of being reminded of like what it feels like to have a beat land with an audience for the first time ever, that's special, man. You know, like, and you could feel it, you know, a couple of seats away. I was like, oh, that's right. This guy is stoked on a joke that just landed. And like that feeling, I think we're a little numb to it, right? Like we make stuff all the time and sometimes it's with audiences, sometimes it's not. Sometimes you're always seeing like the the flaws with whatever it is you made, but like to be reminded of just like that purity of like, oh, it's neat to make something that connects with people, and to witness it is really special. If you have the budget and the bandwidth to go to them, and you've heard good things, right? Like there are regional festivals that can be a bit of a bummer. The screening circumstances aren't great, or they're not super organized, and that can come from a lot of different people and a lot of different reasons. But if you've asked around and people have said like, oh, last year I was touring with my film and we had the best time at this place, you have to apply. Follow those leads and apply, because over the years we've made a lot of friends who you can ask advice of, you can connect with, you can commiserate with. We talked earlier about like building your tribe. All of those people are going to be there, and we're not feeling quite as competitive or hustly or nervous as you would at like a South by Southwest or something like that. You know what I mean? Like there's less of a hustle and bustle. You're just there to celebrate film, and that gives you the opportunity to connect with people in a more meaningful way. And those relationships are going to help you, even if it's just you helping them somehow. You know, like that you're building your film community. And I don't know that always happens in larger, more crowded festivals in quite the same way. And so that's the other reason to do it, basically. So you recharge your batteries, you have a great time, you watch it with real people, and you get to connect with other filmmakers in a more meaningful way. That sounds great to me.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you just one more question that sure. Absolutely neither one of us is qualified to answer. But I'll bring it up anyway, because I know it's the question that a lot of people have and questions that we've had also in the past. What's your advice if you have finished a film and you have gotten into a pretty good regional film festival? You know, you got into Newport Beach or Sidewalk. So you get into one of these festivals. It is exciting. You've heard great things. Some you maybe even know someone got an agent out of it, or like a deal, or met a screenwriter that they collaborated with on their next project. But you have not yet applied to Sundance, Tribeca, South by, Toronto, Cannes, Berlin, you know, whatever.
You're saying, should I hold out your world premiere for one of those bigger festivals?
Yes. Yeah. Does it matter?
Sundance, you hear about first, right?
Well, it depends when you finish your movie. You finish your movie in February, you know.
Boy, if you finish your movie in February, I have two answers. The easy answer is like, if you finish your movie in February, realistically, you should just, you know, wait a year, basically, and apply. The nice thing about Sundance is that it is the kickoff of the festival season, and Sundance is premiere only. There are a lot of other festivals that are premiere only as well, but like Sundance is the one you'd wait for. And so it's nice to just kind of get it done. And then all of those decisions are a little bit easier thereafter, right?
But how realistic should you be about your odds of getting into Sundance? And also, how valuable is it to postpone things for a year where you know that this could be, A, helping you with your career? You know, you want to make more features. You want to get TV. You want to show your work. And B, you know, if you don't get into Sundance, then now you're going to be doing all these things you could have done a year ago.
Right. Yeah, you're just delaying for a year. Well, and that was going to be the second part of my answer.
And yeah, momentum.
And also, frankly, you know, with our film, to being realistic about it, we're proud of our film. We love our film. Audiences love our film. You know, it's connected with people. And the confidence has been reinvigorated in terms of just like, oh, yeah, like people really get it. You know, it's not for everyone, but it's for a lot of people. And also, I know it's probably not a Sundance film. So the realities of the way that festivals work is they often have certain mandates, right? So like, do they have social issues? Do they have a certain level of star that's going to help with their sponsorship quotas? Is it from an underrepresented voice? There's a lot of things that would make it more attractive to a film festival. And there are plenty of straight comedies and rom-coms from all sorts of different types of people who get into festivals, for sure. It's not that it's impossible, but I just knew that our film wasn't like a straight-up festival darling. And we were okay with that. So we didn't really, if it wasn't for the pandemic, we wouldn't have bothered with festivals at all. But it was because the inventory...
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was not really the plan.
Why? Can you elaborate on that?
I mean, for all of those reasons. Basically, because it's a holiday film, it needs to be released in November, basically. And so that makes the timing of most film festivals really tricky, right? So if we shot 2019, beginning of 2020, pardon me, the plan was to go ahead and edit and then distribute it and, you know, get it up on VOD and stuff that year, was kind of like the fast track version, right? So there wouldn't have been time for film festivals really. Mm. And then because there was so much inventory, it was like, okay, well, it doesn't make sense to try and distribute it this year. So we'll go out to some of our favorite places that we have connections. Maybe we can get a waiver, kind of that history of touring with films, and call on our favorites basically and do like a shorter thing that we can kind of maybe build some heat and some buzz and some, you know, we always pass out like a clipboard with like people to write down their email addresses so that if they love the film, they'll get an email when it's up and released and stuff, which is actually, I think, a really valuable and powerful thing to do. And I think a cribbed directly from our friend Liz Manischel. But yeah, so to answer your question, you do need to be realistic with yourself. And just because you don't premiere at a big festival doesn't mean you don't get distribution. You just have to be smart about where you fit into the marketplace, and that you can spend a lot of money on festivals you're not going to get into, and you could probably spend that money on marketing instead, and it would probably be a better use of your money and time.
Yeah, I will say just to serve as like it's not really a counterpoint, but like another thing that I've noticed. We premiered my movie at AFI, which is a pretty good festival. They don't have a ton of movies, and they do premiere actually real like Hollywood studio films at that festival as well. Like my year, they Black Swan premiered there, the Darren Aronofsky film. There was a bunch of like really good films and also some not so good films that premiered at my AFI. And all those filmmakers are there, and it's like right in the heart of Hollywood, and it's really kind of glamorous and glitzy and fun. You get to do like step and repeat, and Getty's there, all that stuff. We actually kind of knew one of the programmers at Sundance, and we asked him what he thought of the movie, and he liked the movie. He said it doesn't feel that Sundance-y, but because it's like a unique version of that movie, there is a chance. He thought it was like, you know, well made and good performances and things. So, you know, it was like a 50% chance is what we felt. And we really said like we could go to AFI, we could be kind of like the big fish in the small sea, because
the bell of the ball, right?
Yeah, because in terms of indie films, like they have their film, a bunch of films that already have distribution there. And then they had like literally we were accepted into this program called the Breakthrough Program, which is like the section for films that don't have connections to the festival. And there are only six movies, and Ava DuVernay had a film in that program also. And so we knew that like we would get a lot of press. We'd be in LA, we'd be in Hollywood, all our friends could come to the festival, and like we'd sell out for sure. And so we ended up choosing to go with AFI, like the, you know, one in the bird in the hand, whatever.
Bird in the hand. Yeah, I think that's right.
So since then, I do feel like people that have even had a short at Sundance 9 years ago
have a slight leg up
if you literally know nothing else about them other than they're a Sundance filmmaker. Like there is something like you could, and we won AFI, we won the audience award at AFI. So even though it's like, I at the time felt like this great accomplishment, we got distribution, we did, you know, the movie did fine. I still feel like now, 10 years later, even 2 years later, like being able to say Sundance, and I've had friends that had films at Sundance that I actually didn't even probably belong at Sundance, but because they had a Sundance film or just like a short.
Sundance
or,
is like a...
Yeah, right time.
It's a badge of honor.
Yeah.
I would agree with that.
I'm saying it, everyone will tell you it doesn't matter, and I'm saying it actually kind of does matter.
I don't know who says it doesn't matter. They are
well,
wrong.
The people that you're crying to, where you're like, I didn't get into Sundance, I didn't get into Tribeca.
Sure.
Then those people will tell you that it doesn't matter.
Yeah, no, it matters. It's helpful. I guess the flip side of that is that there are plenty of people who will tell you that these small regional festivals no one's ever heard of don't matter. People will say that to you for sure. Agents will say that to you.
Well, yeah. They don't matter to them.
Right, right. And that is true that an agent doesn't care that I won Best Comedy at Breckenridge. They don't give a fuck. Yeah, and bringing it up maybe makes them roll their eyes and makes me lesser in their eyes somehow. Perhaps, depending on... I'm painting agents with a pretty broad brush here, so that's not fair to all of them. But what my point is that to the rest of the world, people don't know the difference between AFI and Breckenridge. And it is nice to be a big fish in a small pond. And depending on where you are, where your movie lays in the ecosystem, sometimes a regional festival is a good opportunity for you to be that big fish, right? To win an award, you know? And I think there are some other... There's a halo effect around that. Winning an award does give the film validation that just somebody else thought it was good, you know? And there are tiers, right? Like, certainly saying you're a Sundance winner is way better than saying you're a regional festival winner, but that doesn't make it not worth your time, I guess is what I'm saying.
Correct. Yeah. I do think what you're saying about, like, having fun and, like soaking in the moment.
A victory lap, man. Yeah. You worked so hard on your movie, right?
Yeah, and you can go to Philadelphia Film Festival or Florida Film Festival or Breckenridge, just you, and just... go do whatever you'll be invited to do. Mm-hmm. You'll meet people. You can't do that at Sundance. Sundance, you got to get the publicist. You got to get this. You got to remix the film. Mm-hmm. You got to start like investing all this money into your film and your people and drama and like who owns what. And at the end, there's still a good chance you won't sell your movie.
Sure.
So, they kind of serve different purposes, it seems like, is the conclusion exactly. I'm coming to.
100%. And I think that they're both valid, I guess is what I'm getting at. And so like... And that's not to say that there aren't bad festivals out there. There are. But ask around, you know?
Yeah.
And the more established you are and the more relationship you build with those different festivals, the easier it is to get into bigger and better festivals. And your name gets out there and people have heard of you. And all of that stuff is incremental. Like, I think of Amber Seeley, who we talked with a few weeks back. You know, she really stands out as an interview that I think is special in that she's just like... She took it one step at a time and has a multi-million dollar movie in the theaters right now. And like, just put in the work, put in the time. And that's kind of part of what this show is about.
Yeah.
Is those incremental steps.
Now, I know I told you that I was asking you my last question, but I have a second last question.
Yeah.
Do you think regional film festival, you're kind of at the beginning of your career. It's you get into whatever, Nantucket. You live in L.A., and it's your short film, and they are not going to pay to fly you out. They're not going to put you up, but you're invited to come.
Yeah.
Do you spend your own money to go there? How important is it?
So part of that question is like, how much money do you have? You know, are you an engineer and that's your day job and you're, you know, making movies on the weekend and stuff?
No, you like PA. Let's say you make okay money, or maybe you're an editor in house at BuzzFeed, okay? And your short got into Nantucket.
That's perfect. Yeah, yeah. Great question. Your short got into Nantucket.
Yes.
So there's a handful of variables there. I think the quick answer is yes. I think you should splurge on a festival or two if your basic costs are covered. You know, if you're making a living and this isn't a reach. You know, you might go into a tiny bit of debt, but you could recover from it in a month or two. Wouldn't be a big deal. Yeah, I'd say go for it. But that's a privileged statement, you know. But I think that, look, if you live in L.A., flight out to Nantucket's different than driving out to Phoenix. Or there are a handful of festivals, especially these. So that's another thing about these regional festivals. They're all in towns that have an infrastructure for tourism, right? Like the reason that the Ojai or Breckenridge is such an easy example, that's a ski town at the beginning of fall, right? So like it's their off season. It's still beautiful. You know, we as short filmmakers, we went with Chrissy's film Killed in Action. We got a room for free. They comped us a room. So like ask around, see what sort of waivers there are. Heartland, we've got a festival or we've got a feature. They don't have the budget for rooms. And like that's, each of them is going to be different, right?
Yeah.
And so that's going to be the big determining
factor. The festival
factor
that gives the $100,000 award.
I think it does.
Yes,
it
we
does.
Were up yeah. for it. The Crystal Heart yeah. Award. And the movie yeah. that beat us was a movie that had already made, it was an Australian movie that had already made millions and millions of dollars. Uh-huh. I'm so bummed.
Yeah, that is a thing that's true, is like people, for whatever reason, they like to award winners. You know, when people are on a hot streak, when they're just like, oh, they're racking up awards, that's when people like to give them an additional award.
Right.
You know. But yeah, to answer your question, I think it is worth it, but I think that you can be strategic about it. So like if you know you don't have the cash to fly all the way out to Nantucket because you live in LA and you just got laid off or whatever, maybe don't apply to Nantucket, right? Ask around. I guarantee your friends, if they live wherever you live, there's probably a few easier festivals that you could drive out to, or you maybe crash with a friend or whatever. But it is worth the effort. You know, it is an investment in yourself.
Yeah. My totally unscientific advice, which is kind of in tune with yours, is look at the festivals you got into, choose the two coolest ones, and just mm-hmm. go to those.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it gets trickier when, you know, people are mid-run and they haven't heard back from everyone yet.
Right.
That's when it's a little bit harder and you're playing a little bit of a guessing yeah. game.
And if there is a festival that's in your hometown, 100% go there.
100%.
And you can tell the quarterback on the high school football team to go fuck himself. yeah. Your short is playing at the Poughkeepsie.
That's right. And he's festival. Like, yeah, I'm a board member.
It's like, I own this.
That's, that's why you got in. Yeah.
Well, cool. Well, so Matt, it was great chatting with you about festivals and about the creative process, but I'm wondering if you have just one more moment to give us an unpaid endorsement.
Unpaid endorsements!
So my unpaid endorsement is slightly misleading because, in a sense, we were paid in a camera. Basically, we had a sponsor. We're still giving away Blackmagic gear here and there. But
you wouldn't endorse it if you weren't into it.
100%. That is true. So they gave us a Blackmagic 6K Pocket Pro. And I haven't owned a camera in a long time. I've got like, I'm staring at like a Canon T2i for camera heads out there. That's a pretty old camera. That was like the last camera I bought.
Mm-hmm. I've been using a TI-85.
yeah, it is like that. So it's a great camera. Everyone knows how great the images are, how small it is, form factor is great, it's totally affordable. There's a lot of reasons to love that camera. But the thing that I realized is the thing that is extra special to me about it, the mind-blowing moment that I had with it, was that it's got a nice big touch screen on the back. And what that has facilitated is an interface that is utterly intuitive.
We're talking about like the Blackmagic camera.
The Blackmagic. Yeah. So like I can just, you know, point at the thing that I'm trying to do. All the menus make complete sense. And as a result, the barrier between me trying to figure out how to use the tool and getting the results that I'm aiming for has broken down significantly. It feels like I'm using my phone, basically. But with all of the kind of extra pieces and the control that you expect out of a DSLR, basically. I can manually focus things. I can adjust the ISO. All the stuff that you can do, that normally a camera you can do. And so to me, the thing that I love about it is just that, like, it feels effortless to control the camera in a way that I don't have to think about. And so that's special, man. That's great. Like, even the cameras that I've loved, they're a little hard to navigate, or you have to dig through things, or you have to think about it for a second. And this is all just, again, because we have a little bit more real estate on that LCD screen and that it's touch rather than, like, turning a wheel or whatever. It's been a game changer for me. It's been really, really wonderful.
Yeah, and the picture quality is like insane,
incredible.
Right? Yeah, especially given the price of the camera, which is like less than $3,000.
I think it's like $2,500,
and it like, shoots raw. It's the dynamic range, the color, man. It's just like so amazing. I'm
always jealous of people like film students, but now I'm truly jealous. Like, there's not a good reason for people to not have one on every, you know, dorm.
Yeah. And you could make like a movie that plays in movie theaters like with that camera, yeah. like a or big budget commercial. I mean, it's really great. I have, you know, the Sony A7S III as well. And I've played with both of them, and I love my Sony for a lot of reasons, but that you can't argue with the picture on the Blackmagic.
Yeah, yeah. And you hear my point about like
the intuitive,
just the menus. Yeah.
Anyone can use it.
It's really anyone.
It's the best.
If you know, yeah, it's awesome. So that's my semi unpaid endorsement.
Yeah,
Oren, what you got, buddy?
Well, so this is going to be annoying to some people because this is not something that's accessible to everyone. But I happen to live in a neighborhood where you can get fiber internet, and it is so great. But I'm going to tell you real quick the story of getting it installed because it actually wasn't very easy to get it installed. I called AT&T. I heard from actually a previous guest, Eric Kissack. He's just editing this new show. It's like a biopic about Tommy Lee and Pamela Anderson.
Oh, cool.
For HBO.
Awesome. Yeah.
And I was like, how are you editing from home? And he's like, I just upload, download. I was like, isn't it slow? Like uploading, you know, all these like giant ProRes files or whatever. He's like, yeah, I've got fiber. I was like, oh. I should get fiber. I checked it out. I had Spectrum cable. I was like, oh, the fiber is actually $10 cheaper, and it comes with free HBO, which I'm already paying $15 a month for. Anyhow, so I'm like, I'm going to switch to AT&T.
You got me so excited they don't have it in my neighborhood.
I know, it sucks. And also, you know, I know we all know this, but like AT&T now, they'll give you like $1,000 off of like an iPhone. So anyway, I was a Spectrum person. Now, this week, I'm an AT&T person. But so they send out the tech. It's so easy. They're like, yeah, we'll send someone there on Wednesday, whatever. I call on Monday. I'm like, awesome. On Wednesday, I'm going to have the fastest internet. It's going to blow my face off. And the tech comes, and he's like, you know, there's a pole. We live in L.A. Like, all the fiber wires, you know, in newer cities, they're all underground. But here, they're all in the air, like, going on these poles, like electric poles from house to house. And I had to go to a meeting, and he tells my wife, he's like, yeah, I climbed the pole. There's no connection for fiber at your house. I'm sorry. My computer says there is, but there isn't. So I'm going to take off. And I had his phone number, and I texted him. He's like, yeah, they're going to send a tech. And I wait a week and another week, and nothing's happening. And I'm texting him. I'm like, what's going on? He's like, sorry, I guess they have to like install these things, cut all these trees. They have to, you know, basically it turned out like that I was not going to get fiber. So I called AT&T again and started the whole process overnight, and I had a tech scheduled to come here, and I tried to do it at a time when I was free. I had a really busy week, and he shows up, and I am not gonna let this man leave my house mm-hmm. without fiber connection. So he comes, I'm like, before he comes, like I'm talking to a friend, he's like, why don't you use your drone to find the fiber connections in your neighborhood? Like, oh, yeah, because I was climbing these light poles and everything and being dangerous. And so I fly the drone around, and I really can't find... By the way, I'd already, like, cut all these leaves away from my tree, my light pole. I can't find the connector, and I do all this research, what it looks like, and I fly two houses over. I can find one on one side and two houses over the other direction. I find one on the other side, and I'm like, okay, so we do have fiber here, and there's something that says AT&T on my light pole. And so when the tech comes... I tell him, like, hey, we don't have it here, but I think it's two houses down. Long story short, he's like, well, look, the good news is you do that. You're right. That is your connection. It's like literally like not the next house over, but it's a house past that. But the bad news is like that's too long of a cable run. Like I have to run it through all these trees 30 feet up in the air. Like there's no way I can do it. I'm sorry. I'm going to have to. He's like, I don't want to cancel this order, but I'm going to have to cancel order. I'm like, listen, Juan, like you and I are going to do this with that attitude. You're never going to install fiber anywhere. Like, let's do this. I will help you. You're going to want to hire me to be your assistant. And he's like, okay, bro, let's see what we can do. And we go, the triplex where the actual access is, like, it's a whole long story of how we even were able to access that yard. But we access that yard. And I'm like, okay, dude, I have casting in like 2 hours. Let's just go to my house. Let's bring the cable and let's do it. And he's just working in slow motion. And long story, slightly shorter, I ended up pulling all the fiber. Like, I climbed on the trees. I climbed on the roof of all these houses in my neighborhood. I called my neighbor. I was like, I'm going to be in your yard, dude, just so you know. And I found this other cable. It's like a...
Are you using a ladder? Or what? I'm confused.
I had a 15-foot
like
ladder.
Tarzan style.
And then I get high in the trees, and I climb on the trees. And I pulled, like, a 200-foot... fiber optic cable run from the light, the like power pole in my backyard through all these trees. I fed him like branch through branch. I was basically copying the exact same path that the cable was going through.
Uh-huh.
Which again, it was like about 30 feet off the ground. So I had to go to the top of my ladder, my 15-foot ladder, and then climb like another 5 feet up into the tree. But luckily my neighbor has these like really good, very climbable trees. I pulled the cable and it's fiber optic cable. So if you don't know about fiber optic, it's like literally a glass cable, right? Mm-hmm. And if you kink it, if you like bend it like more than 90 degrees, it will break the glass. So you have to be very gentle with it. You can't bend it too extreme. And you know, 200 feet of cable is like you're carrying a lot of cable, but I did it. And I thought this guy was going to help me. I thought we were going to be a team, but this guy, very, very large man, no way he can climb these trees. He can barely get up my light pole that has handles, and it's like he's got all the tools to do it. So I pulled the whole thing all the way three houses down to the neighbors. He climbed up the pole and connected the side of the fiber. And then when we got back to my house, now I have casting in like half an hour. He's like, yeah, let me work on this. In the meantime, the whole time he's calling his boss like every 5 minutes, like, yo, boss, it's going to take forever. And I hear him on the roof like, oh, what the fuck, man? Why am I doing this? Like, he's just complaining.
Yeah.
And so I just pulled it from the light pole to the roof of my house. And then he routed he connected it to the side of the wall or whatever. But then this man was too big to fit under my house in the crawl space. And I wanted to like bring it into my office. So I go in the office, I get the drill, I do everything. I'm like telling my wife to like knock on the floor in the house so I can hear it from underneath. And with like 4 minutes to spare before my casting, I have the whole line run. And then I go into my casting. I'm just filthy, just sweat and soot and leaves in my hair.
You've been on roofs and under houses.
I do like this 3-hour casting where I have to talk the entire time. And I do it outside because this man is like working in my office to connect the modem and the router and stuff. And then about halfway through my casting, my wife comes over and she just has like the Wi-Fi network name and the password. And I type it in and it's like everything, my casting gets so much better. Everything is just great. And then I came inside and I connected my iMac with the Ethernet cable to the router. And dude, before I was getting like 100 down and between two and three megabits up on Spectrum, mm-hmm. with like an insane lag, and now I have like 950 down. Whoa. And 950 up, and I can like my Dropbox.
That's the thing about fiber,
like
up
butter.
You can
shoot a like for 100 hours on your Blackmagic Pro 6K. Put on your hard drive, and it'll be up in the internet like faster than you can copy it to a hard drive. It's so blazing fast. And I'm so excited, and it's cheaper than my cable internet. So if you are in an area that has AT&T fiber, highly recommend it. If they tell you you can't get it, but you know that it's nearby, if you've flown your drone, you know, two houses down, like just have them come over there and just cajole them.
Just shoot it. Yeah. Just shoot it. It's not responsible for any injury you may.
Just cable it.
While climbing on your neighbor's. Yeah. Roofs.
And I'm like, this guy should be thanking me. He told me it was the long. It's like he was unaware that I did the entire job, but he was like, "This is the longest run I've ever done by myself." I'm like, "Are you insane? You did not even climb up anything except for one light pole." Anyhow, if you need fiber installed, give me a call. my new gig.
Well, I do, but they don't offer it in my neighborhood.
Well, maybe if they offer it one block away, we can make it work.
Yeah. You can follow us across all social media at Just Shoot It Pod. You can visit us and learn about all the things that we talked about at justshootitpod.com. Tell your friends about it. We're on Spotify. Yeah. We're on Facebook.
Email us.
Give us a like. Somebody email us at justshootitpod@gmail.com.
This episode is edited by our old pal, Jay McAuliffe. Thank you, Jay. The music you're listening to is from the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. And I'm curious if what percentage of our listeners listen this far in the episode. If you are hearing this, email me, justshootitpod@gmail.com, your name and your website, and I will say it at the beginning of an episode.
Ooh, there you go. Little incentive. Thanks, everyone. Goodbye.
Bye.
Mom. mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.